This is the Everything Financial Radio program. I'm your host, Dennis Tubergen. Welcome. If you're a new listener, this is where we talk about what's going on in the economy and what it might mean for you and your nest egg. On today's program, I have joining me special guest expert, Mr. Barry Eichengreen. Professor Eichengreen is the George C. Pardee and Helen N. Pardee Professor of Economics and Professor of Political Science at the University of California, Berkeley. He's also been a senior policy advisor at the International Monetary Fund, so he'll be joining me momentarily, and excited to have him on the program. Also today, I want to talk about a topic that's making headlines this past week. Europe is slipping into deflation, as is New Zealand, as is China. Is the United States next, and what might it mean for you and your money? I'm going to explore that in detail during the second and fourth segments of today's program. And next week on the program, you'll want to be sure to mark your calendars to tune in or go to the iTunes store to download the podcast for next week's program. I have joining me on next week's program, Mr. Peter Wallison. Mr. Wallison was actually a general counsel to President Reagan and also served as counsel to the Department of Treasury back in the 80s. And he's done a fascinating study on the role that regulation played in the financial crisis. So we'll be talking to him on next week's program. I want to remind you that we do have a new retirement rules class coming up on February 21. That will be held at the downtown campus of Western Michigan University. If you'd like more information, all you have to do is visit the website, newretirementrules.com. The website, again, is newretirementrules.com. And you can register there, or you can get some information. The cost for the class is just $49. That's for you and a guest. The $49 covers lunch for you and your guest, as well as all the handouts and the book you'll receive when you attend. If you haven't yet been to the class, go check it out at newretirementrules.com. And look forward to seeing you at the next class. I'm pleased to have as a first-time guest on the Everything Financial Radio program, Professor Barry Eichengreen. Professor Eichengreen is an economist who holds the title of George C. Pardee and Helen N. Pardee Professor of Economics and Political Science at the University of California, Berkeley, where he has taught since 1987. The professor his best-known book is Golden Fetters, The Gold Standard in the Great Depression, 1919 to 1939. And his most recent book is Hall of Mirrors, The Great Depression, The Great Recession, and the Uses and Misuses of History. So, Professor, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Professor, let me just jump right in. And in your book, Hall of Mirrors, you draw some parallels between the financial crises that we now know historically as the Great Depression and the most recent financial crises, which really occurred in 2008. Could you just, for the listeners, maybe explain some of those parallels?
There were striking parallels before the fact, before the crisis and the crash. A housing boom and bubble in the 1920s in Florida, and to a lesser extent in the Midwest in cities like Chicago and Detroit, overly loose monetary policy by a newly created central bank, the Federal Reserve, and all kinds of excesses in financial markets. So I think you put those three things together and you have the elements of a crisis and a crash, which is what we had in 1929, and again in 2007-2008. The policy response in the two cases was quite different. Milton Friedman, the University of Chicago economist, famously accused the Fed of compounding the crash and causing the depression once it began. Ben Bernanke, in 2002, at Milton Friedman's 90th birthday party, famously said, "You're right, Milton, we," meaning the Fed, "did it," meaning the Great Depression, "and we won't do it again." So the Fed did respond more aggressively. I think historians will conclude much better this time around. Quantitative easing and zero interest rates were controversial, but we avoided another Great Depression due to the the policy response, in my view.
So, Professor, given that according to some of the research and data that I've read, given that the too big to fail banks are now bigger than they were prior to the financial crisis, and given that the derivative exposure is higher, arguably, and for our listeners that may not be familiar, derivatives are essentially side bets that banks make based on certain things happening, like maybe interest rates movement. Are we setting ourselves up for a repeat of 2007 and 2008, in your opinion? And why or why, and if so, why? And if not, why not?
I think we are vulnerable to another crisis. Not a repeat of 2007, 2008, but something slightly different. Every crisis is different from its predecessors. I think we have failed to do enough to strengthen the banking and financial system. So, exactly as you said, the problem of banks that are too big to fail is still there. We haven't done enough to force feed additional capital to the banks. We haven't done enough to downsize big banks. We have failed to force derivative securities onto exchanges where they can be more safely treated. We failed to reform credit rating agencies, which I think were part of the problem before the crisis. And the irony is that our success at preventing another Great Depression led to this failure to do more to reform the financial system. In the 1930s, the prevailing financial system was totally discredited by its collapse. This time we prevented the system from collapsing, if barely. And that allowed the banks to regroup, the defenders of the current system to continue to argue in its defense. So the irony is that success was the mother of failure, heading off another financial crisis, prevented us from doing more to strengthen the system. That's the argument at the core of my book, Hall of Mirrors.
Well, if you're just joining us, we're chatting today with Professor Barry Eichengreen, who is the author of Hall of Mirrors. And, Professor, we've got about 3 minutes left in this segment. I've had guests on the program who say that quantitative easing and the policy response to the financial crisis simply kicked the eventual problem down the road, that we're going to have to deal with this down the road, and that eventually the next crash or crisis will be worse than the one in 2007 and 2008. What would you say, or what would your response be or comment on that analysis?
My response would be that task number one starting in 2008-2009 was to stabilize the patient, staunch the bleeding, prevent another depression, stabilize the economy, get growth going again. And then down the road, it becomes necessary and important to strengthen the system and prevent the same from happening again. I worry, as I said before, that we haven't done enough to strengthen the system. But I think letting the economy collapse, allowing unemployment to rise not only to 10%, as actually happened, but inaction would have allowed it to rise to 20% or 25%, as it did in 1933. That would have been too high a price to pay for teaching the banks and teaching the markets a lesson they wouldn't forget.
Well, Professor, moving ahead, and we've got about a minute and a half left, so we can pick it up in the next segment as well. Moving ahead, what should the Fed's policy be?
The Fed, I think, needs to focus on hitting its inflation target of 2%, and that's what it's doing at the moment, and use other tools, not monetary policy, but other tools to regulate the banks, prevent them from using too much leverage, not allow them to hold too little capital. The mistake that was made in 1929 was that the Fed raised interest rates because it was concerned about frothy financial markets. The Fed needs to keep its eye on price stability and economic stability when it sets interest rates and use other instruments, what the technicians call macro prudential tools, regulation, in other words, to deal with financial excesses. And I'm a little bit encouraged that that seems to be the approach the Fed now is taking.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there in this segment. Our guest today is Professor Barry Eichengreen, author of The Hall of Mirrors. And we'll continue our conversation with him when Everything Financial Radio returns. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program. I'm your host, Dennis Tubergen. I look forward to continuing my conversation with Mr. Barry Eichengreen in the next segment. You know, this past week, if you've been looking at the headlines at all, you saw that deflation is making headlines. In fact, just one example, there was an article published by Bloomberg this past week titled ECB, referring to the European Central Bank, ECB seeks to inject up to 1.1 trillion euros into economy in deflation fight. Well, what does all this mean, and why is it important to you? Well, on today's program, I want to talk about inflation and deflation in very simple terms, explain to you how it works, and more importantly, help you understand how you may be affected moving ahead. Now, many, including financial professionals from my experience, don't understand deflation. So I'm going to give you just a bit from my book, New Retirement Rules, that talks about deflation. And I'm going to give you an example that I think will be helpful in understanding this really important economic concept. Now, if I were to ask the average person to define inflation, I would most often get the answer, too much money chasing too few goods and services. Too much money chasing too few goods and services makes prices go up. And when we think about inflation, we think about rising prices. But that definition, the one I just gave you, is really a poor definition. Properly defined, inflation and deflation simply describe the level of money in circulation. Inflation is an expansion of the money supply, and our banking system is biased toward money creation and expansion. In fact, as Mr. Eichengreen pointed out, the Federal Reserve, the United States Central Bank, is trying to achieve 2% inflation, and as he noted, they haven't been doing it. Now, deflation is inflation's polar opposite. Deflation is a contraction of the money supply. Think about deflation as money's disappearing act. Now, a lot of folks believe that today's massive money printing by the Federal Reserve will lead to inflation and higher prices, which are symptoms of inflation. But history tells us today's economic conditions at today's level of money printing are far more likely to lead to deflation. Now, the Federal Reserve went on a money printing binge, and now the taper has kicked in. But in spite of this money printing binge, as I just mentioned, history suggests that a massive contraction of the money supply is likely. Now, why is that? Well, the explanation is really quite simple. You have to start with the fact that most of today's money is debt, not actual currency. Now, the idea that today's money is debt is a foreign concept to many, including many financial professionals. But let me give you an example to try to make the point clear. Say you have $50,000 cash in a bank account. You could go to your bank, withdraw the $50,000 in cash, bring the cash home, and stuff it under your mattress. That would give you $50,000 in actual currency under your mattress. Now let's say a relative of yours comes to you and asks to borrow $50,000. While you're open to helping out the relative, you'd like some collateral in order to protect yourself. So your relative offers to give you the title to her car and will allow you to place your name on the title as a lien holder. With this offer of collateral, you decide to take the $50,000 from under your mattress and loan the money to your relative at an interest rate of 5%. After all, the money was earning a 0% interest rate under the mattress, so you're happy with the 5% return, plus you have some collateral to help protect yourself. As long as your relative is creditworthy, and that's an important point, as long as your relative is creditworthy, you still have a $50,000 asset. The asset is just no longer cash, it's debt that's owed to you, but it's still an asset. If you were to put together a personal balance statement, you'd list the $50,000 loan payable to you as an asset. If you hadn't made the loan to your relative and still had the cash under the mattress, you'd list the cash as an asset of the same value on your personal balance statement. So the point is, whether the $50,000 is actual currency or a $50,000 loan that you've made, it's still $50,000 of money. When you give your paper currency asset to your relative, you're converting a cash asset to a debt asset. Cash and debt are both money. That's the point. Debt or credit extended is spent exactly the same way as actual currency. If you go buy a house and get a mortgage, you're taking on debt, but that debt got you a house. It spends exactly like currency. That brings me back to my original point. Most money today is debt. Debt owed by one person or entity to another person or entity is an asset to the person to whom the debt is owed. And in our financial system, most money is the liability of another person or another entity. This money remains an asset as long as the borrower is creditworthy. However, should the borrower not pay up, the asset's value may be reduced and the money disappears from the system. Technically defined, this is deflation. Deflation is simply money disappearing from the financial system. So let's go back to your relative. Let's say your relative comes to you after you've given her the loan of $50,000 and tells you she can no longer make payments on the loan. She's lost her job, and in spite of her best efforts, there's no way she'll ever be able to pay you back. She voluntarily brings you the car you took as collateral on the loan so you can attempt to recover your asset. After a few weeks, you realize the car might bring $20,000, which is nowhere close to the $50,000 you're owed on the loan. You simply decide to cut your losses and sell the car. You pocket the $20,000 and write off the $30,000 loss to bad judgment. That is $30,000 that's just disappeared from your personal balance statement, and that $30,000 has just disappeared from the financial system. When most money is debt and debt levels are too high to possibly be paid, money will disappear from the financial system and the money supply will contract. This is deflation. So the Federal Reserve and now the European Central Bank's going to also attempt to do this. And the Central Bank of Japan and many of the other central banks around the world have been attempting to add money to the system faster than money disappears through the system through defaults on debt. Trouble is, they're fighting an uphill battle. Given the level of debt that exists today worldwide, simple math tells you there's more debt that can ever possibly be paid. There's a simple economic rule that has proven itself to be true for more than 2,000 years. If there's more debt that can be paid, not all the debt will be paid. If there's more debt than can be paid, not all the debt will be paid. And that's exactly where we are today. There's far more debt that can ever possibly be paid. Since most money is debt, this means money will have to disappear from the system as defaults occur on the debt. Money will do a disappearing act and deflation will be the result. That's where we are right now. Central banks have been staving off deflation but not hitting their inflation targets, and we'll talk more about this in the last segment of today's program. And now deflation is beginning to set in and policymakers are concerned. What will deflation mean to you? Well, I'll talk about it more in the last segment, but the first thing I'd point out is that historically speaking, stocks don't like deflation. Stocks don't do well. With interest rates this low and the next move in interest rates being up as credit risks get higher, as it gets more risky to loan not only individuals but corporations and governments money, interest rates will spike. That can be really bad news if you have a 401k plan or IRA with stocks and bonds. I'd like to invite you to learn more. We talk about the idea of inflation and deflation and where we're going and possibly when at our new retirement rules class. Our new retirement rules class is being held again on February the 21st at the downtown campus of Western Michigan University. If you'd like to get more information or register while capacity remains, just visit the website newretirementrules.com, and you can register there. I'll be back after these words.
Give me your money. Just give me money.
Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program. I'm your host, Dennis Tubergen, and I'm enjoying my conversation today with Professor Barry Eichengreen. The professor's latest book is Hall of Mirrors, and it's a terrific book, draws some great parallels between the Great Depression of the 1930s and the Great Recession, which, as you know, began in 2008. And, Professor, I'm going to just pick our conversation up where it left off in the last segment, if I could. You'd mentioned that one of the Fed's objectives is to hit its inflation target of 2%. And yet, when you look at private sector debt levels that exist around the world, and I'm thinking particularly of Japan, and there you could talk public sector debt as well, in spite of just massive easing, Japan cannot hit its 2% inflation target. So how much longer can the Fed hit that inflation target of 2%, given the massive level of debt that exists both in the private and public sectors?
Actually, the Fed has been missing its target. It's been undershooting for some time now in inflation. I want to remind your listeners, has actually been running below 2%, and there have been worries for the last couple of years about deflation rather than inflation, and the Fed has been pushing hard to get inflation up to a healthy level. That may sound contradictory, but that's what a 2% inflation target is all about. Now it seems to be achieving that, which is why it is preparing to raise interest rates later this year. The U.S. doesn't have a Japan-style problem. We don't have a debt-to-GDP ratio of 130% net like they do, or 190% gross debt to GDP like they do. And we don't have European-style debt problems either. So I do worry about fiscal policy and about debt down the road. I worry about health care costs and entitlement spending. But right now, I don't think they're the main issue on the dashboard of the Federal Reserve.
Do you think that policymakers here in the U.S., then, by your statement, do you think they'll be able to stave off deflation and continue to have modest inflation moving ahead?
I think we're in reasonably good shape at the moment in the United States that the Fed is approaching its 2% inflation target. The fears of deflation we had last year are receding. Economic growth has been accelerating in the U.S. a bit. So we're in good shape. The Europeans and the Japanese are not. So in Japan, they have announced some more government measures to try to get prices up. Prices have been falling there, and get economic growth going. In Europe, everybody knows that on January 22nd, the European Central Bank will announce a modest program that resembles quantitative easing, because prices are now falling in Europe, and given their heavy debt levels, that is a very serious problem for them.
So let's go back and let's talk about Japan for a moment. I had John Malden on the program not long ago, and his comment was that Japan is really a bug in search of a windshield, that they can't possibly recover from their economic issues. Would you agree with that? And what's a good policy for Japan moving ahead? What policy that would work?
Well, John is always good for a quote, and that's a great one. I think, however, that after 20 years of ineptitude in Japan, they're beginning to show signs now of readiness to grapple with their problems and whip deflation and jumpstart economic growth. So what do they need? Mr. Abe said 2 years ago they need to fire three arrows, which are monetary stimulus, expansionary fiscal policy, and deep structural reform. they've done the monetary policy, and the Bank of Japan is now doubling down. They are finally now beginning to do the fiscal policy right as well. Not borrow more, but have the government spend more and raise more in taxes, given that the private sector is not spending. That's the way to get demand going in Japan. Structural reform is always the hard part. It's hard in the U.S., it's hard in Europe, it's hard in Japan, but they have taken some steps to encourage female labor force participation, which you need to do when the population is shrinking, as it is in Japan. Will they do the other deep structural reforms they need? I don't know. 20 years of history says maybe not. If you're an optimist like I am, you have to say maybe so.
So, Barry, let me just ask, there are those that say that, and you'd mentioned in the first segment that, and let's get back to your book here, Hall of Mirrors, that there were a lot of parallels between, or I guess preceding the Great Depression and preceding the financial crisis, which began in 2008, one of them being a real estate bubble and bust. What would you say to those that say that the stock market now is in a bubble, the U.S. bond market's in a bubble, and it's because of the Fed's quantitative easing policies?
I would say I agree that valuations are high, and that their high level makes me a little bit nervous, just like other people. And I would agree that Fed policy has been one factor contributing to those high valuations. When the Fed cuts interest rates on safe assets to zero, people begin to look toward riskier assets, and they bid up the prices of those riskier assets. But I think it was necessary to do that to, as I said before, stabilize the economy in 2009-2010, get growth going again, bring down unemployment. And if you're worried about financial institutions with risky positions, the solution to that is not to raise interest rates, but to slap heavier regulation on them, to require them to hold more capital. So if they take losses, they have a cushion, to require them to use less borrowed money so that they can absorb losses in the event that prices come down. If people are uncomfortable about the high level of the stock market, and they may be, they shouldn't be in the stock market. That would be my response. But to have allowed the economy to collapse back in 2008-2009, to allow innocent people to be, who hadn't caused the crisis, to be thrown out of work as a result, would have been to solve today's problems at a very high price.
So, Barry, moving ahead, what would be your outlook for the U.S. economy? Certainly the GDP growth has been good. On the other hand, when you look at the unemployment rate, which I believe the headline right now is 5.6%, and compare it to the labor force participation rate, there's a lot of folks just not participating in the labor force. So there's a lot of mixed signals out there as far as the economy is concerned, in my view. What's your outlook for the U.S. economy?
I agree with you, Dennis, that the signals are mixed. In the relatively short run, the decline in oil prices is a bonus for the U.S. economy. It puts 750 additional discretionary dollars in the pocket of the average household, which people can go out and spend at the mall, and that will be good for the economy, other things equal. I do not think that we will continue to grow at the rates that were seen in the second and third quarter of 2014. We'll grow at more like 3% rather than 5%. And in the longer term, I'm worried that we don't invest enough in people. You know, I'm an educator, so I'm talking my own book, but I think we need to invest more in vocational training, more in community college to touch on a currently popular topic, more in higher education. We need to invest more. Our government needs to invest more in basic research. And I think we have infrastructure needs in the United States that are not being met, and it's going to be hard to be productive and grow the economy if everybody is on highways that are gridlocked because we're not filling the potholes. That's an issue that I think needs to be addressed.
So, Barry, given you mentioned back in the first segment, and I'd like to go back and revisit it just in the couple minutes we have left here. You mentioned entitlements, and when you take a look at entitlements and certainly interest on the debt, it seems that additional investment is nigh on impossible, and at a certain point, we just have to start cutting spending when you look at it just purely from a math perspective. So give me your take on that comment on entitlements and how it might affect moving ahead, and how do you invest more when you have these looming financial issues?
I think we've already done a good deal to cut government spending. Look at the numbers. Recall the sequester, and 8.5% across the board reduction in non-defense, non-entitlement spending. The Obama stimulus was highly controversial, but it's over. It's done and finished and gone. So right now, the government, federal budget deficit at a little more than 2% of GDP is there, but it's not a big problem. I think the worry is 10 or 20 years out when the population is aging and Social Security bills come due. If we don't succeed one way or another in containing health care costs, that's another long conversation. Different people will see different ways of doing it, but everyone should agree that it's an important issue for society, and if you're concerned about investment, for the corporate sector as well. We do have to address those issues over time. Raising productivity through investment in education and training, basic research and infrastructure is a way to grow the economy and make those problems more manageable.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Professor Eichengreen, thank you for joining us on the program today. We very much enjoyed the conversation and hope you'll come back.
I hope to do so. Thank you, Dennis.
The book is Hall of Mirrors. I would encourage you to check it out, and we will return after these words. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program. I'm your host, Dennis Tubergen. Thanks again to my special guest today, Mr. Barry Eichengreen, for joining us. You know, I want to continue my conversation about deflation and inflation. And if you were listening to the second segment of today's program, I brought up the fact that money is debt. In fact, I think one of the figures I saw that 95% of all money is actually debt. And inflation occurs when the money supply expands. Deflation occurs when the money supply contracts. And because 95% of all money is not currency, but it's debt, when there's too much debt to be paid and debt doesn't get paid, that means money disappears from the financial system and deflation sets in. And that's what's going on all around the world, because we're seeing very, very high levels of debt, not only in the public sector, but in the private sector. And it's really this private sector debt that, in our view, is driving these deflationary forces. Europe is definitely in deflation, and there was a Bloomberg article that I did reference with the headline, ECB, European Central Bank, that's Europe's version of our Federal Reserve, seeks to inject up to 1.1 trillion euros into economy in deflation fight. I'll give you just a bit from the article that was published January 21 this past week. Mario Draghi, who is the head of the European Central Bank, made a proposal that suggested that the European Central Bank buy 1.1 trillion euros of debt. Well, basically, Draghi is suggesting that the European Central Bank do what the Federal Reserve has already done, engage in money printing, print money virtually out of thin air to go out and buy bonds. Well, that hopefully inject some liquidity into the economy. And Europe, with their back up against the wall, at least in Draghi's opinion, has no other option but to try to print money, to add money to the financial system faster than money leaves the financial system through defaults. So essentially, that's what all these central banks around the world are trying to do. They're trying to add money to the financial system to create modest inflation. Almost every central bank wants to add money to the system fast enough to get 2% inflation. But all these central banks, as Mr. Eichengreen pointed out, are missing their targets. And deflation is really a headline, not just in Europe, but all around the world. There was an article published this past week with a headline, New Zealand slips into deflation. I'll give you just a bit from this article published again on January 21. Chances of the Australian and New Zealand dollars trading at the same value, which incidentally, they were very close to being on par. But the chances of the Australian and New Zealand dollars trading at the same value have been dealt a real blow after New Zealand's quarterly consumer price index showed the country has slipped into deflation. The consumer price index, or measure of inflation, fell 0.2% in the December 2014 quarter, the first fall since the final quarter of 2012, following three consecutive rises of 0.3%. Bank of New Zealand's currency strategist said, a range of indicators suggest a disinflationary environment emerged over the course of 2014. To translate that, the country is in deflation. The money supply is contracting. An article published on MarketPulse this past week, also on January 21, carried this headline, Deflation Fears Surface in China. Lenin Yu may be Beijing's worst nightmare. The 24-year-old is waiting for car prices to fall before buying. This mindset, if it becomes widespread, could threaten to trap China's cooling economy in a deflationary rut. With the world's second largest economy growing at its slowest in nearly a quarter of a century, risks of deflation in China are growing just as a slump in global oil prices raises similar concerns in Europe and other parts of the world. Consumer inflation eased in 2014 to near a five-year low, and policymakers are worried it could fall further because factory gate prices have been dropping for almost 3 years. So here we have Europe, we have China, we have New Zealand, all slipping into deflation with policymakers doing what they can do to try to fight it. Well, what about here in the United States? Do we have to worry about this? And why is this a problem, which I'll get to momentarily? Falling prices, that doesn't sound like such a bad thing, does it? Wouldn't it be nice if your dollar would actually buy more? I'll explain in just a second. This is from a MarketWatch article. The risk of deflation in the U.S. is becoming all too real. The last time the U.S. economy seriously faced deflation was in March of 2009, when the Core Consumer Price Index, which is again the measure of inflation, fell below zero. The Federal Reserve under Chairman Ben Bernanke acted with a most unconventional tool, something called quantitative easing. And very simply defined, quantitative easing is printing money, creating money, literally out of thin air, to buy bonds and, in this case, mortgage-backed securities. So the recent sharp drop in headline inflation is ringing some alarm bells. This is again from the MarketWatch article. It is largely due to a plunge in energy costs, and we all know that if you've filled up your vehicle with gasoline lately, you're probably enjoying this deflation. And Janet Yellen, when asked if this was a problem, she said this is transitory, meaning it's not going to last all that long. But as the MarketWatch article, in my opinion, correctly points out, for the effect of cheap oil to be transitory, we need to see signs the U.S. economy can continue improving despite deflationary pressures in Europe and China. Now, if there's lower gas prices, it seems that the economy should be booming. The U.S. economy is dependent 70% on consumers like you and I going out and spending money, but retail sales in December were terribly disappointing. So the Fed's got a problem here. If this price slide continues, it could result in consumers delaying purchases. And as consumers delay purchases, the economy slows. Another issue with deflation is that if it persists, it could erode corporate profits and may very well derail this six-year bull run in stocks. Again, stocks don't like deflation. The Chicago Tribune ran an article this past week with the headline, "Deflation is just a recession away." I'm going to give you just a bit from that article. Since the Great Recession, the Federal Reserve has worked hard to boost the economy. Part of the Fed's mission was to keep core inflation at a pace of 2% annually, and we've already talked about the fact that they failed to hit that target in spite of massive quantitative easing or money printing. Now, the idea of falling prices, the article says, and I just mentioned, seems like a good thing, but when deflation is persistent, it can put into motion a scary downward spiral. It starts when the economy cools, which prompts companies to reduce prices in the hopes of luring customers and maintaining sales volume. That's happening now in China. But as companies make less money, they could then cut jobs and/or wages, which could then cause consumers to spend less in order to service their fixed costs like taxes and mortgages and rents. The longer deflation goes on, the higher the risk that consumers and businesses become accustomed to the situation and delay spending, hoping they'll eventually be able to buy those same goods more cheaply and invest more efficiently. They also become a lot less willing to borrow. This is classic in an autumn season that transitions to a winter economic season. In an autumn economic season, it seems that prosperity is everywhere. Think the 90s, think the tech stock bubble. And debt levels slowly rise to unsustainable levels. Then during the winter economic season, debt has to be purged from the system. That's what happened in 1929. From 1929 to 1933, consumer prices fell by a cumulative 25%. Now, Jim Rickards, who's the author of The Death of Money and has been a guest here on the Everything Financial Radio program, had some very interesting thoughts, and this is from an article in which he was quoted. Rickards says, "We're in a depression since 2007. And I might point out that a depression is, by definition, deflationary. Mainstream economists don't use the word depression. They don't like to talk about it because it's not mathematically defined. A recession is two consecutive quarters of declining gross domestic product with rising unemployment. The definition of a depression is a little more vague." He said, however, you can have growth during a depression. The Great Depression from 1929 to 1940 had good growth from 1933 to 1935. Then it went back to a severe recession within the depression in 1936 and 1937. We talk about inflation and deflation at our New Retirement Rules class, and I'd like to invite you to go to the website newretirementrules.com and get more information about the New Retirement Rules class. And if you'd like, register there while capacity remains. Our next class will be held on February 21 at the downtown campus at Western Michigan University. Again, the website, newretirementrules.com. That's our program. Hope you enjoyed it. Tune in again next week. Bye.